If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In this ad for the Mobil 1 brand, I have 30 seconds to remind you about your first time driving. Remember the feeling, the freedom, how the world felt bigger and smaller at the same time? Because you were in the driver's seat. The truth is, driving never changed. You did. You got a job, a phone, and then a phone that was also a computer with emails that could find you anywhere, and then you were trapped. But here's the good news. It's never too late to break free. Mobil 1, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/radio to learn more.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
We remember you here, Mr. Ward. For many years, you put gold on the farmer's table. Your words and deeds have truly been blessed. You saved us from hardship, and we salute you for it. You're leaving this ice-capped country and heading back home, where you will enjoy honour and wealth, but you will not be forgotten by those who love you, our dear Mr. Ward.
That was Catherine Findlay telling the remarkable story of an English fish merchant who played a key role in the history of Iceland.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Pike Ward is a little-known figure whose fascinating story has been uncovered in a new book. Born in 1856 in South Devon, he was a fish merchant who surprisingly went on to become a Knight of the Grand Cross of the Icelandic Falcon, Iceland's highest honour. Pike Ward's photographs and diaries were scattered and forgotten for decades until they were rediscovered in 2016. Catherine Findlay, an Icelandophile working at the Devon County Archives, found his scrapbooks uncatalogued and ignored, and recognised their importance. She became captivated by them and tracked down Pike Ward's great-grandson, who it turned out had a set of Ward's diaries in a box under his bed in Bristol. BBC History Magazine's content director Dave Musgrove caught up with Catherine in Devon to discuss the story.
I'm here with Catherine Findlay, author of a new edited volume of The Diary of Pike Ward, who lived from 1856 to 1937. He was a Devon fish merchant who played a curious role in the independence of Iceland. So we're going to talk about his life and times. Catherine, tell us what you know about Pike Ward's early life. What was his first few years like? What do we know?
We know that he was born in Teignmouth, which is on the south coast of Devon, and that's where he grew up. His family were shipbrokers. His father, George Perkins, had his fingers in lots of different pies. He was a shipbroker. He was involved in shipping insurance. He was involved in the traditional trade between Devon and Newfoundland in cod. And they were a successful middle-class family. They were well-known in the town. His father was a member of the local board. His mother was very well-known. So they were a kind of affluent middle-class family. And they came from a religious background that was based in Congregationalism. So one of the dissenting churches that were very strong in the West Country. So they were socially fairly progressive, fairly liberal, and that was the milieu that he grew up in. He was very close to his mother. She was a fascinating woman, very ahead of her time. And when his father died, she took over the business, and she ran the business for years and years, which gave him a kind of unusual amount of freedom, really. He didn't have to take over the family business and stay in Teignmouth for the rest of his life.
Okay, so far, so interesting. But perhaps we wouldn't be chatting about him now if he hadn't gone on and started taking an interest in Iceland, which is where you found more interest in him. So why did he go to Iceland? What happened there?
Well, he, I think his personality was, he's a very gregarious person, very outgoing and curious and interested in the world. And I would imagine that life in a kind of small Victorian seaside town was possibly not the most exciting place for a young man. And the cod trade with Newfoundland was in decline. The cod stocks had started to collapse. So that wasn't really an option to go and pursue that sort of adventure that his father had. So he looked north, he looked to Iceland, and there was really no one else trading directly with Icelandic fishermen at that point. There were great opportunities for British trawlers in Icelandic waters, but no one else was trading with Icelandic fishermen. And he saw an opportunity that no one else had seen. How he first had the idea, I don't know, nobody knows. But Iceland was certainly where he kind of found his place in the world, and he fell in love with the place and stayed for 22 years.
So before we jump into that, we should perhaps just dwell on how we know anything about him. So you found a diary that he wrote. Did we know anything about him before that, and how did you find the sources that you've uncovered?
No, I didn't know anything about him at all. It was purely by chance. I was working at the Devon Archives. I hadn't been working there for very long, and someone who knew that I loved Iceland and was a frequent visitor mentioned that they thought they'd seen some scrapbooks, Icelandic scrapbooks, somewhere in a store. So I went looking for them and I found them. There were 8 photographic scrapbooks on a shelf in a storeroom, but they weren't catalogued, so nobody would have known that they were there. No one had ever really looked at them. Holiday scrapbooks from that period are they're lovely things, but they're not that rare. So I think perhaps someone had thought they were just holiday scrapbooks, and they'd never been, no one had ever taken any notice of them. But I was just fortunate that I knew the country well enough to know as soon as I opened them that these weren't holiday pictures. This was someone who knew the country intimately. There were photographs from all around the country, and images that I'd never seen anything like them. Pictures of ordinary people at work, places that tourists would never go. So I knew that the collection had enormous social history value. And I just became really captivated and fascinated by who was this person with this strange name who, like me, had fallen in love with Iceland. And so that's kind of set me off on trying to find out who he was. And that's when I started to realise just how important he was, how significant he was. And I tracked down his great-grandson, who very kindly gave me a whole box of material that included letters, more photographs, and 3 handwritten diaries from 1906. So he had a complete record of his life in 1906.
And this was all completely unknown until you came across it?
Completely unknown. It turned out there are three significant collections. There's the photographic scrapbooks that were in Devon Archives, which no one really knew were there. There was the collection that was owned by Stephen Ward, Pike's great-grandson, and that was in a box under his bed in Bristol. And there was a collection of objects at the National Museum of Iceland, about 400 objects. But they had not really had a great deal of context to those objects before. So one of the biggest kind of joys of this project is bringing those three collections together, and they all inform each other, and it's just an incredibly rich collection.
Okay, so a great detective story there. So this guy, this middling sort of merchant from South Devon, decides that Iceland's the place he's going to make his fortune sometime, what, in the 1890s we're talking about now?
Yeah.
So he's in his mid-30s, he's looking for a new opportunity. One would imagine that going to Iceland from Devon wasn't a particularly easy thing to do. Was it a well-trodden path, or was it something that was quite difficult?
No, it was still fairly adventurous in those days to go to Iceland. So you had to go by steamer from Leith and go via the Faroe Islands. And that could be a very rough crossing. And then once you arrived at the coast of Iceland, you had to then go all the way around the coast to get to Reykjavik. So, yeah, it was still a fairly intrepid kind of journey. There were the odd sort of very adventurous tourists who would go, but they tended to stick to the well-known sites and be taken by guides. There were British trawlers working off the Icelandic coast. So there were trawlers from Hull and Grimsby and Aberdeen. As mechanised trawling had started to develop in Britain and as the cod stocks in Newfoundland declined, that became quite lucrative to go and trawl off Icelandic waters. But British trawlers were behaving pretty badly at that point, and they were in competition with Danish trawlers, and the Icelanders weren't getting anything out of that trade, really. So what he did was quite different. The first time that he went, he bought some fish from some British traders, but he very quickly had two quite important realisations, one of which was that the Danish and German buyers were only buying the bigger fish. They wouldn't buy small fish. So all the small fish were going to waste. So anything smaller than 16 inches was going to waste. And the other thing he realised was that Icelandic fishermen had no cash. They could only barter their fish with merchants who were mainly Danish, who controlled the economy. It was a very unfair arrangement. They could only sort of barter on tick, and that kept them trapped in poverty. And Pike realised that if he paid cash, if he dealt with them directly and paid cash, then he would be benefiting himself, but also the Icelanders who'd never had access to cash before.
Okay, so step back a second. You've mentioned Denmark a couple of times there. So can you just give us a sense of what Iceland was like at the turn of the 20th century or in the latter years of the 19th century? It was basically a Danish territory at the time.
Yes, it had been ruled by Denmark for hundreds of years with varying degrees of kind of control from Denmark. And during the 19th century, they had started to relinquish some of that control, but they were still very much in charge. But Icelanders were starting to demand more and more independence, and that came in stages. So you had in 1845, the assembly was re-established, the Althingi. Then you had in 1874, a new constitution was granted, but still under the Danish crown. In 1904, Home Rule was introduced. So there were all these kind of stages along the route of Denmark relinquishing control. And there was a great movement in Iceland clamouring for independence. But you have to remember that this was a population of about 80,000 people with very little in the way of natural resources, a country that had survived the most desperate poverty and now wanted to sort of stand on its own two feet. And without fishing, that just wouldn't have been possible, without commercial fishing. And I think we're very used to thinking of Iceland as a fishing nation, a nation that's built on trawling, which it is. But that's really only a 20th century phenomenon. Before that, commercial fishing just wasn't developed in the way that it had in other countries. And that was partly because the social conventions in Iceland the social laws had restricted people. And if you didn't own farmland, you had to work for someone who did. So that meant that people couldn't go and set themselves up as fishermen. It was essentially outside the law. And as those restrictions had started to relax, that was the moment when pike arrived, at that point when suddenly people could start to move to the coast and could start fishing as a full-time occupation. But as I said, they had no access to cash. So it couldn't, the industry couldn't develop at that point without an injection of cash.
So you mentioned that if we think of Iceland today, we think of a fishing-based economy. I mean, I guess we also think of a tourism-based economy. Mm-hmm. And if we think of it at all, when maybe we worry about the credit crunch and things like that. But we think of it as a place of prosperity. Nowadays, reasonable prosperity. But what you're saying is that 100 years ago, 120 years ago, it was a penurious place of poverty and not much opportunity.
Absolutely. And it's one of the things that when I talk to British audiences about this story that they find most surprising, because as you say, we're used to thinking of Iceland as a wealthy Nordic nation. But very recently, really, in the great scheme of things, most Icelanders lived in abject poverty. It was by far the poorest country in Europe. People had next to nothing. And that was a result of various factors. In previous centuries, there'd been climate change, there'd been disease, there'd been population collapse. The Danes had implemented trade restrictions, trade monopolies, which cut Iceland off from the rest of Europe. So all of these factors together had led into this sort of downward spiral that meant that people were living in conditions that were really appalling and very isolated as well, because villages and towns had never developed. So everybody lived on isolated farms with this very restrictive social order that prevented people, and if they weren't landowners, from bettering themselves, really. But during the 19th century, things started to improve. So the climate improved slightly, which meant that the population increased. There was pressure from Denmark to relax some of these regressive sort of social laws. So things were slowly getting better, and people were demanding that their Icelandic identity should be kind of respected. And a lot of that was inspired by the sort of folklorist movements that you saw in the rest of Europe during the 19th century. And there was a group of students in Copenhagen, Icelandic students, who spent a great deal of time and effort producing magazines and pamphlets and praising the motherland and restoring a lot of pride in the language and the culture. And all of that fed into this desire for independence. But I think it's pretty inconceivable that independence could have been achieved without a functioning economy.
And the functioning economy was, as you say, broadly or greatly helped by the actions of this one man. I mean, how far should we be taking this? Is it going, you know, crazy to say that Icelandic independence wouldn't have happened when it did without the actions of this Devonian fisherman?
I think it's impossible to say what would have happened if he hadn't been there, but he made an enormous difference. And I don't think we haven't explored enough the link between his money and eventual independence, but there certainly is a link there. There's a case to be made, absolutely, because he was injecting cash into communities that had never had the means to improve themselves before. So having cash meant that they could then invest, they could buy bigger boats, they could buy nets, they could buy wood and build fish stores, they could do all sorts of things that were just completely out of reach without access to money. And the fact that Pike made a success of this business also attracted other British buyers. So then you had companies like Copeland and Berry from Edinburgh coming in and going into competition with him and buying the same type of fish. So suddenly you had this huge new market opened up. And that money was then, so this is fishing in open boats, inshore fishing in open boats. But the people that made money from that were then able to invest in trawling and develop the trawling industry, which is the absolute bedrock of Iceland's achievements in the 20th century. You can't think of Iceland's transformation without trawling, they're absolutely interlinked.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
In this ad for the Mobile One brand, I have 30 seconds to remind you about your first time driving. Remember the feeling, the freedom, how the world felt bigger and smaller at the same time? Because you were in the driver's seat. The truth is, driving never changed. You did. You got a job, a phone, and then a phone that was also a computer with emails that could find you anywhere, and then you were trapped. But here's the good news. It's never too late to break free. Mobile One, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/radio to learn more.
So Pike Ward was instrumental, if that's not putting too much emphasis on helping to bring in a money economy to Iceland. And he goes around the country, around the islands, talking to people, making contacts in Icelandic. I mean, did he learn the language or?
Yes, he did, absolutely. That is quite an achievement in itself because it's not an easy language to learn. And that really was one of the things that set him apart from other foreigners. And you have to remember there was quite a lot of bad feeling in among Icelandic fishermen towards the British, certainly the trawlers and the way that they were behaving. So for an Englishman to become so well loved and well respected in that context was quite something. And he first started to deal with fishermen in the East through talking to them through friends of his who were photographers, strangely enough, who acted as translators. But that was only really at the beginning. And then he learned the language and he learned how to communicate with people directly. And he spent years, every year he would go out around the country. He would travel by steamship, in open boats, by pack horse, and go to the most remote corners of the country, dealing with the fishermen and buying from them directly. And one of the things that makes him so important as a documenter of that period is that he had this great gift for making friends with people. So everyone from the poorest fishermen to the highest officials in Reykjavik, he knew and he was on friendly terms with, and he had all these great stories and anecdotes. And in his photographs, you can see how relaxed everybody is with him. So there's the story about his own significance as a historical figure, but then he also has this other great importance as a writer and a photographer, someone who was documenting that way of life that soon would disappear as Iceland became a modern, wealthy nation.
Okay, so he was a man who made friends easily, had lots of contacts, he learned language, and there's this lovely little cartoon that we were just looking at in the plate section of your book, where he's described as, what is it, the most famous man in Iceland? Is that the
best known man?
The best known man in Iceland. So that's pretty. I mean, it was quite a small country, as you said, but even so, that's quite a statement, isn't it? So obviously, his influence was known and respected by the Icelanders themselves.
Absolutely. And actually, when he left, he was presented with a poem by an association of fishermen in the West. And I'll just read it to you, actually, because it really gives a sense of how much difference he made and what they thought about him. And this has been translated from Icelandic. It's called "To Mr. Pike Ward. We remember you here, Mr. Ward. For many years, you put gold on the farmer's table. Your words and deeds have truly been blessed. You saved us from hardship, and we salute you for it. You're leaving this ice-capped country and heading back home, where you will enjoy honour and wealth, but you will not be forgotten by those who love you, our dear Mr. Ward. Bjolva wishes that your beloved country will celebrate you on your return, and that you will have a good life over there. With us, your name will never be forgotten, but written in gold." And I think the fact that that's coming from fishermen, not kind of professional poets, it really shows you just how much they loved him. That's not kind of overstating it. Partly because of his personality and his warmth as a person, but also the enormous difference that he made to their lives. And for quite a long time, there's several of these references to gold, to him bringing gold to the country, and I assumed that that was metaphorical, kind of poetic way of describing it. But actually, in, I think it was 1896, the bank in Reykjavik actually ran out of Danish banknotes, and the fishermen trusted him enough to take the cargoes that they'd promised him, and he sent them gold from England. And from then on, he always paid in gold until there was a bank that could issue Icelandic banknotes. So he really did put gold on the farmer's table, as they say.
So you mentioned this group of Icelandic scholars in Copenhagen who were agitating for independence, or at least talking about the Icelandic nationality. Was Pike Ward in any way involved in those discussions? Was he in any way advocating independence for Iceland, or was he simply doing his business transactions and making his business success? Was he in any way actively looking to advance the cause of Icelandic independence, or was that a byproduct?
I'd say that was a byproduct. I think it's probably wrong to think of him as a kind of political figure. That wasn't what he set out to do. He was a merchant. He was doing business. He was making money. He was doing it in a very ethical way, in a very fair way, and he was known for that. But he wasn't any kind of crusader for any particular cause or other. I think he admired the self-belief and the determination of those that were agitating for independence. But by this point, pretty much everybody in Iceland was pro-independence. But there were different strands within that of thinking around what independence would mean and motivation for wanting independence. So there were socially conservative elements within that who wanted to keep the kind of Icelandic social order as it was. There were very much more radical elements with that wanted a more progressive version of independence. So I think Pike was slightly out of remove from all of those arguments, and he had Danish friends, he had Icelandic friends. I think he could probably see both sides of the coin. And he's fairly ambivalent about independence, and I think possibly maybe had some misgivings about it as well. Would the average poor Icelander be better off in an independent Iceland, or would they be better off with the Danes? I don't think his mind was entirely made up on that issue.
That's curious, because when I was reading it, and given the timescale, my mind was sent to thinking about Africa at the same time as the scramble for Africa, when British imperialists were actively looking to colonise rather than decolonise. So it's slightly curious to have this figure involved, but as you say, not operating in a separate way. But whether or not he thought about independence as a positive thing for Iceland, he was recognised for his involvement in Iceland and his contribution to Iceland, wasn't he? He was actually given an award, so tell us about that.
Absolutely. He was awarded the Grand Cross of the Icelandic Falcon, which is the highest honour that the nation can confer on anybody apart from a head of state. And he was enormously proud of that and enormously touched by that, because his identity changed during the time that he was in Iceland. And he became really Anglo-Icelandic, I suppose would be the description of it. So he certainly challenges the idea or the stereotype, if you like, of the sort of Edwardian Englishman abroad. He very much became Icelandic in many ways, felt himself to be Icelandic, and was hugely proud of this honour that he was given. But he didn't die in Iceland. He came back to Devon and retired. He bought an Edwardian villa, very typical kind of English Edwardian villa, but he called it Valhalla, and he covered it with Norse carvings, and he filled the inside of the house with Icelandic objects, and he really pined for Iceland in his later years. So to receive the falcon was meant everything to him.
And he lived this kind of curious double life, didn't he? For, as you said, for 22 years, he was basically going to Iceland for the summers and then coming back, like migrating like an overwintering bird between Iceland and Devon.
Yeah, absolutely. He would spend the 3 months of the winter, those were the worst months, he would spend back in Devon, and then he would go back to Iceland in the spring and return again in late October, November. And yes, as you say, he had a kind of double life. So he had a wife in Devon, and they had two sons. They had a son called Edward. And then in 1901, she had a second baby, but she died in childbirth, sadly. And the child also died 10 days later. And she was called Grace Agnes. But what's interesting about the second son was that Pike chose to call him Thorarin, which is an anglicised Icelandic name. So between Edward and Thorarin, you can see Pike's identity kind of changing in lots of ways, and that's just one indication that he gave his second son an Icelandic name.
How did Icelandic independence finally come to pass?
Well, this year actually is the centenary of Icelandic sovereignty. So in 1918, after the First World War, Denmark and Iceland became two separate countries under the Danish crown. And that situation lasted until the Second World War. And as you say, the British marched into Iceland, the Germans into Denmark, and the Danes were in no position to continue that arrangement. So full independence, the complete break with Denmark came in 1944.
And, famously, Britain and Iceland clashed after that period in the Cold Wars, mm-hmm. when there was continued disputes over fishing rights. Was Pike Ward, the Englishman, in any way remembered by the time of those conflicts? Was his reputation already beaten the dust by that?
I think for a long time, older fishermen would have known the term for saltfish that were sent to Britain, the smaller saltfish that were prepared in the way that Pike had taught people, they were known as Ward's Fisker. And so his name lived on in that. But as the British appetite for saltfish declined, that product fell out of use. So his name sort of disappeared with it, I think. No, his very sort of central role in the story of what was happening in Iceland in the early 20th century has really been forgotten. I think partly because he isn't buried in Iceland, he didn't have descendants in Iceland that we know of, but also partly because it's a very pivotal point in Icelandic history. It's a very Icelandic story, and so the role of a foreigner perhaps doesn't fit so well with that, and has been kind of forgotten. And so it's just it's an absolute pleasure to be able to put it back and restore his part in that story.
And there's going to be an exhibition about him or of his photographs in the National Museum in Iceland next year?
Yes.
In 2019?
September 2019, an exhibition is opening at the National Museum of Iceland that will show a selection of the photographs from his scrapbooks. And that's been a really fascinating process, actually working with the National Museum of Iceland on that, because the photographs which they find most exciting, perhaps I wouldn't necessarily have known that they were the most significant images, and that's to do with the ways of life that he was depicting. He was showing things that don't appear in any other photographic collection, any other Icelandic collection. Ways of life that obviously people knew what life was like from written accounts and the rest of it, but we haven't seen it in photographs before. And so that's really exciting. And We'll be launching the book in Iceland and having the exhibition, as I say, in September 2019.
So do you have any thoughts on what that exhibition and the publication of the edition of his diaries might do for his reputation in Iceland? Do you imagine that people will come back to his story and start to take a new interest in that, and perhaps in the story of Icelandic independence as well?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I don't think, certainly in Iceland, the interest in that period has never gone away. But this is a new voice on that period. It's a new angle. One of the things that makes it valuable as an account is that there's such a great cast in the book. There's so many other people that he knew who were significant figures, that not only is it his story, but it's an insight into the stories of lots of other significant people at the time as well.
Okay, and finally, do you have a favourite moment in the diaries? Any particular bit that you find particularly interesting or fascinating?
There are so many. I think one that always... the most moving passage, I think, is he witnesses the storm in 1906, which is still considered Iceland's worst maritime disaster. 70 sailors died, and he witnesses that firsthand. And his account of that is very, very moving. So I always find that very touching. There are so many wonderful descriptions of the landscape, the Northern Lights, his various adventures. And he's very, very funny as well. And again, it challenges the sort of stereotype of diaries from this period. He's a very, very funny writer. And one incident that I always particularly enjoy is when he got into trouble with his landlady for throwing soup out of the window, and his account of how cross she is with him is hilarious. So he's very likeable, very readable.
That was Catherine Findlay. The Icelandic Adventures of Pike Ward, edited by Findlay, is out now, published by Amphora Press. And that is about all for today. But we will return on Monday, when Lord of the Rings director Peter Jackson will be talking about his new film on the First World War.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.